The following is a podcast of Periodically Speaking, recorded live at the New York Public Library on April 8th, 2008.
Hello, good evening. Welcome. My name is Karen Fusoni, and I am the Helen Bernstein Librarian for Periodicals and Journals. And it's my real pleasure to welcome you here tonight to the New York Public Library for Periodically Speaking. This is actually our fourth year of hosting this series, and we actually have two seasons per year. We have the spring and the fall. And just a couple of comments. It's been really wonderful working with CLMP on this collaboration, where we're able to do a couple of things. We get to fill this beautiful public space with everybody. We get to provide a venue for emerging writers, and we also give literary magazines center stage, which is part of what we try to do in this room, where we have a really wonderful collection of contemporary literary magazines. So it's a real treat for us to have all of you here and highlight that collection, and also encourage you to come back and use the library and check out the collections, both in person and on the web. I want to thank our friends at CLMP, Tasha, Jay, and Jeffrey, for being so great to work with. And also invite you all to stay around after for a reception, which is going to be right out in the hall. Now it's my pleasure to introduce Jeffrey Leppendorf, the Executive Director of CLMP, who will introduce the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Karen. Delighted to be back here again and see such a nice crowd. This series, Periodically Speaking, is a way for us to share a tiny, tiny sampling of the probably about 2,000 literary magazines active in America. That said, probably 1,000 of those magazines, of which I speak right now, might publish one issue and then fail. It's a much more select group that lasts a long time, and an even more select group that lasts a very long time. And we, in fact, have two of those here tonight, so it's a real privilege. Two that have made it past the 50-year mark, which is quite an achievement. And a newer one that has already made a mark, so great program for you tonight. I want to say a quick word about CLMP for those of you who don't know what that is. There's, in fact, a card at your table with some quick facts about CLMP, so I'll just give you a very quick background. The Council of Literary Magazines and Presses was founded 40 years ago to help independent literary publishers through the business of publishing. We started out only serving literary magazines and added small presses later, but we still have a very, very special, extra special place in our hearts for literary magazines. Literary magazines really are the home for new writing. Without literary magazines, it would be virtually impossible for many, many writers to ever make it to a reading public. And they are also a home not only for emerging writers, but also for well-established writers, often with sometimes longer pieces, sometimes pieces that might be less commercially viable, sometimes pieces for very, very special, you know, more select audiences. I think what's really terrific about a literary magazine, perhaps even more than a great novel, I mean, a wonderful novel you can read over and over again, and we all have our favorites, but what's particularly wonderful about a literary magazine is that if you find one you love, there's another issue. It's a periodical, and it's like your favorite book that just keeps going. So it's really a treat to find a great magazine. And we're going to begin with one of our favorites, introducing to you today, the Literary Review. And I would like to summon Walter Cummins, who will introduce our first reader and tell you a little bit about the Literary Review.
I thank I thank CLMP and the library for inviting us to invite an emerging writer from our pages. I'm pleased to represent Literary Review, TLR, and introduce Geronimo Madrid. As an emerging writer, we published an issue just a couple of years ago. As noted, we've been around 50 years. We're now in our 51st year of quarterly publication, and it's been fundamental to our mission to recognize important new writers and poets from the U.S. and internationally. There's an anniversary book that we had done for our 50th, and it's on that back counter, so as you please take a copy. It includes a a photocopy of a letter from William Carlos Williams to our founding editors, excerpts from writers we published over five decades, and lists of writers that we've, many more that we've been on our pages. Half of our more than 100 issues have been devoted to contemporary literatures from countries, regions, language groups from around the world. We're proud to have published the first English translations of many major writers, a number of whom went on to win Nobel Prizes. At the same time, we've given early prominence to significant American writers. In fact, just the past week, I had notes from two prize-winning novels from writers who appeared in their earliest fiction in our pages. We anticipate that Geronimo will be another writer we'll be proud to have recognized at the beginning of his career. His story, Goanna, which appeared in our winter 2007 issue, came to us with the endorsement of Peter Carey, one of his mentors in the Hunter College MFA program. Goanna is set in the middle of a barren area of the Northwest Territory of Australia and centers on a large lizard called a Goanna and an unhappy couple, Nate, who is a native of the region, and Carla, his homesick Filipino bride, chosen from a photo on a website. The story demonstrates Geronimo's strengths in creating characters, emotional tensions, and a very strong sense of place that's integral to the drama. In addition to TLR, Geronimo's fiction has appeared in Bomb magazine, Story Southcom, and in the Drunken Boat Pan Literary Awards website. He's published travel writing in the New York Times, and Gerald recently completed the Hunter MFA program. There he received a Hertog Fellowship that involves doing research for and receiving mentorship from an established writer. In his case, it was the novelist Patrick McGrath. As I noticed, he was able to study with one of his heroes, a novelist and program head, Peter Carey, and I just learned tonight that he also studied with Colson Whitehead, who's in the audience. Now he teaches English composition at Hunter and is a freelance project manager for the website of the Independent Film Channel. He's worked as a travel editor and obituary writer, and as a security guard at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Jero was born in the Philippines and came to this country when he was 7. He grew up in Arlington, Virginia, and later on in Jersey City. He did his undergraduate work at McGill University in Montreal, and now he lives in Brooklyn with his wife Jessica and his 2-year-old son, Nate. And he's noted on a side note that he's addicted to riding the bicycles and thinks New York should be a more bike-friendly town. And given the news last night, that may be the alternative to congestion pricing. Tonight he's going to read parts of a new story, and I'm very pleased to introduce Geronimo Madrid.
Hi, everyone. I just want to thank the library and CLMP, and especially Walter and Renee at the Literary Review, who are back there. You know, as most of you can imagine, kind of writing fiction is an activity that involves a lot of kind of self-enforced isolation. And it's really something special when a magazine reaches out to you or back out to you and says, hey, you know, we'd like to publish the story that you sent us. And then reaches out again several months later and says, you know, there's a reading event and we'd like you to come and represent the magazine. You know, both things are really an opportunity and an honor, and I just want to say thank you. So, as Walter said, I'm going to be reading from a new story. It's called Gutshot, and it's something I've been working on, and I think it's coming into shape nicely. So, you know, this is, I think, a great opportunity to kind of share it. Do I sound okay, by the way? Okay. So the story, what you need to know, or you know, what I should tell you beforehand, the story is about a character named Rex Chauvel, who's an Army veteran in his mid-40s, and he's living down in Boynton Beach, Florida. He's basically a waiter and a scuba diving bum. And when his friend when his friend Cap's son goes off to war, this guy Rex ends up. His friend goes to Iraq, his friend's son goes to Iraq, and this guy Rex ends up covering for Cap's son on Cap's dive boat. So he's basically working in his son's stead. But what also happens is that he ends up having an affair with the son's girlfriend while the guy's away. So kind of messy, but I'm going to read from two scenes. The first will be just Rex and Cap taking a bunch of divers out into the ocean. And then the next scene will have Evie, the girlfriend, in it proper, and it jumps ahead a little bit, and their affair has started. So, from Gutshot. When we come out into the open ocean, I see the forecast was right. It's a rough day out, the wind blowing like a bitch. We plow into the big breakers, and Cap works his magic with the throttle, giving power when we're climbing up the face of a wave, and easing up when we're coming down the back. I hold on to a grab bar up on the ceiling and look at the jam-packed aft. I count again, 12 divers, all in various states of preparation and undress, all of them hanging on as the boat seesaws through it. Then Cap yells out, "Talked to Robbie last night, told him not to worry, told him not to worry about the business that I got you signed on, told him just to make sure he didn't get his ass shot off." Good advice. I clap him on the shoulder, and then we're quiet for a while, and I guess Cap's thinking about his son, but me, I'm back in Bolivia. "Hey," I say, "I told you about that time, right? When I took one in the right butt cheek?" I've told him like maybe 6,000 times. "Friendly fire, wasn't it?" he laughs. "I mean, it's usually friendly when you get it up the backside like that, right, Rex?" He said that before too, but I laugh like I do every time. Then I ask him how come Evie didn't come out. "Oh, you know her. Hates a crowded boat, hates a crowded reef. She'll probably come along when it quiets down." "Yep. But I was wanting to see how she was. She's probably all worried about Robbie. And I swear, it was that kind of worry that probably did my own marriage in." After 20 minutes of rough going, we're over the reef. Cap lets up on the throttle, and I head aft, telling everyone to suit up. One of the girls I've been eyeing comes up to me. She's a college kid, slightly built. I look straight into her big green eyes, then give her a quick once-over. Tiny black bikini, pink rose embroidered on the left breast. She says, "How come you don't have your VCD on?" I'm just in my wetsuit, and I explain how dive boats work it around here, with a dive master not going in unless he has to. "Don't worry though," I say. "We'll group you by who's doing the same thing, spearing, bugging, taking pictures, or just plain sightseeing. We also put folks on nitrox together, folks on air together, to maximize everyone's bottom time." I give her a wink, and she frowns at me, so I just go on. "And we give every group a dive flag. We'll keep track of you all from up top, though." The girl nods, but she's knock-kneed and goose-pimpled and scared. Hell, she probably just got her C card with her boyfriend on some holiday in the Caribbean. Meanwhile, the boyfriend shrugs, makes like it's no big deal going in the water alone. He's got half his gear on and can't balance himself, can't help his woman out. The asshole. So I zip her wetsuit up from behind as she holds her hair out of the way. We're like some married couple. Then I check them all one by one, making sure they got their air turned on, that they're sucking on their regs and not on their goddamn snorkels. The boat's tossing and the divers look ready to lose it, so I scream, "Dive, dive, dive," and I clear the boat out, diver by diver, group by group. When it's just me and Cap topside, we lean against opposite gunwales and watch the sea. Ain't no logic to the waves today, just water coming from every direction, crisscross, six-footers hitting us every which way. We keep an eye on the flags as the divers drift with the current. Then a cloud comes in and blocks the sun, and just like that, it feels 10 degrees cooler. Sea spray smacks me on the back, and I can feel it through my wetsuit. Then spray hits Cap on the back, and he flinches, says shit. Behind Cap, a mile and a half to the west, I see the big houses, long stretches of condos snuggled up against the sand. But there's a good portion too where there's still just beach. And I think to myself, that was my dream when I first got here, to live right on the ocean. But I'm still inland in an apartment where I gotta have two deadbolts on the door. So I end up working nearly every day on the boat. I miss diving for myself, miss grabbing my gun and spearing hogs in Cobia. But the money's too good. I'm clearing nearly 100 a day, and that's on top of the waitering money. For the first time in a while, I send my mother a check that is in a pure waste of paper, $875. I tell her to spend it on something nice for herself, although nothing will ever fix up the shit box my brother, sister, and I grew up in back in Paintsville. My brother, who ain't ever stepped out of Tennessee, takes care of Mom, and my older sister, the big shot, supports them both. Then, by the time March rolls around, I bought myself the Avid BCD, and I don't stop there. I buy other stuff, including a new spear gun, stainless steel model, and I hang my old one next to a picture of my daddy on the wall. He's in uniform on the edge of some Korean forest, kneeling next to a wild boar he just shot. He's smiling, but in real life, he never smiled or said much. I'm not complaining, that's just how he was. Distant as the goddamn moon when he wasn't beating on you. So we're gonna jump a little bit ahead now, as I said, to a point where his affair with Evie has started, and I'll just start reading. So Evie and I start seeing each other a lot, 3, 4, 5 times a week. We hang out late at night at my place after I get off from the grill. On these nights, I don't feel tired. It's like I'm plugged in some endless source of energy. Usually, she'll bring over some beers and we'll watch a movie or play cards or just sit out on my balcony and look out at what I call the scenery, my complex's parking lot. Then we'll end up in bed, fooling around, all that, and cracking jokes all night long. I swear, the girl's having some effect on me. I even start changing my sheets, like once a week, like a civilized human being. But it ain't all perfect. Some nights she'll make excuses not to see me. She's got to hang out with this friend or that, or her aunt wants to do something. And if she's making these excuses, she don't even bother to make it sound convincing. I don't know why she's got to play this game, but it's what she does. Still, for all her putting me off, I cannot stay mad at the girl, and I just keep coming back for more, keep planning and plotting different things to do with her, because I swear, weird as it seems, part of me just wants to forget Robbie. Part of me just wants her to forget Robbie for a little while. Part of me just wants her to stop worrying. And so one day, I come up with the mother of all distractions. I call in a favor and borrow my buddy's sailboat for the day. The boat's a 35-footer, a Columbia, built in 1973. And even though she'll never be the newest or biggest thing out on the water, she is comfy and well-maintained. It's a windy day, perfect for sailing. The sky streaked by a couple of long, low clouds that remind me of sharks. The hull gives out a thub-thub as we cut through the chop. As I motor us out of Boynton Inlet, the sail still tied down, Evie says, "Holy hell, Rex, she's blowing like a bitch today." And I laugh into the wind. It's cute, Evie's wanting to talk like Cap and me. I say, "You know all them white caps? Remind me of the meringues my ex used to make. I swear, bacon pies and blowjobs, it's about all that woman was good for." Evie calls me a jerk off, but she's trying not to laugh. I love making her laugh. "So your friend you borrow the boat from," Evie says, "he rich or what?" "He does all right, but he ain't what you call rich. Boat was given to him by one of the people he watches house for." Then I tell him how it ain't all as good as it sounds, because as soon as my buddy had the boat handed to him, he had to pick up the dock and insurance payments on her, and he had to fix up every little thing wrong with her, from the keel up. And that's where I came in. I helped him out. I helped him work on the boat on and off over 3 years. And now I get to take her whenever I want. Just give him some notice. "Never thought of all that work," Evie says. "Well, it just goes to show, there ain't no such thing as a free boat." We keep on heading south, and Evie takes off her jean shorts and her t-shirt. In her lime green bikini, she leans into me, her skin cool from the breeze, the scent of sweat and sunblock coming off of her. I got one hand controlling the mane and the other on her hip. My thoughts, meanwhile, wander down into a dirty place, and I slip my hand around, feel the tuft of hair just inside the front of her bikini. She slaps my hand away. "Rex, you have got a one-track mind. But you don't mind where that track's going, do you?" "Sometimes I don't mind at all, but I'm just trying to enjoy being out here, okay?" "Roger that." And we sail on like this, touching but not saying anything, passing fishing charters as passengers wave at us from the distance. When Evie puts her sunglasses on, I whisper into her ear, "You look like a movie star." She makes like she don't hear me, stares out to sea. I ask her what she's thinking about. You don't want to hear it, she says. You don't want to hear what I'm thinking about. And I tell her I do. And we go back and forth like this. Finally, she says, just had a moment there, worried about Robbie. But I wasn't just thinking about Robbie, she says. I was thinking, too, how angry I am. How, well, I just feel like the president and all them experts he's got working for him, I just feel like they meant for us to lose or something. The more I read about it, the more I think about it, the more I realize it was doomed from the start. And I just feel like Robbie, me, and everybody, the family over there, we all been set up to face all this worry, to suffer. And I could kill somebody, Rex. I could kill somebody. She trails off, and I nod, and I can't say I disagree with the girl. Shit, listen to me, Evie says. Listen to me go on when you plan this great day out. Hey, I say, you can talk to me about anything. Right, right, she says. She pushes her sunglasses up on her nose. Right, I can talk to you about anything. I notice then that we're coming up on Port Everglades Inlet fast, and I gotta drop sail like now. But it takes me a long time to get the main down because my sailing's rusty. By the time I'm back on the motor, we're close to the concrete barrier at the mouth of the inlet. It's only with a lot of luck and swearing that I get us through. But Evie just sits down on the bench behind me and doesn't make a peep. Boat could get dashed to splinters for all she cared. Soon, I get us pointed down the middle of the intercoastal, backtracking north a short ways. I reach behind me where Evie's sitting, grope for her hand until she gives it up. We give each other's finger a squeeze. And her grip surprises me. The girl's got strength. We pass the 17th Street Causeway, a monster of a bridge that doesn't even have to lift up as we pass under. It's late in the afternoon and the sunlight comes in low and hits the water, the houses, Evie's face and hair. This is a real nice time, Rex, she says. Real nice. You kidding, I tell her? This is the best. Finally, we get to the restaurant and I tie us up on the crowded docks outside Shooters. I help Evie out the boat. She went below deck and came out wearing a denim skirt and a white blouse. Sight of her gets my pulse going. I got on the purple shirt she gave me and khaki shorts and flip-flops. Holding hands, she and I go in, get a table waterside, just like I requested. As we're sitting down, the lights blink on. The lights line in the block, the dock blink on. There are folks sitting around us. Boat people by the looks of them, suntan, dressed like they got no one to impress, and I order us a couple of Bud Lights. I need a whole six pack, Evie says. I got you something. I fish in my pocket for the velvet covered box. I put it on the white tablecloth. Open it. She stares at me a second. She smiles and she pops the box open. Then the smile disappears. She blinks. She's quiet a long time, and I'm afraid she hates it. Well, you like it or what? Rex, she says. Yeah, I say, you like it or what? Here, try it on. I take the ring out of the box. I hold her hand and slip the ring onto her finger. I had to guess at her size, and I got it right. Fits you perfect, I say, and it's pretty. What I got her is a gold ring that don't quite go all the way around. The ends that don't meet being in the shape of a dolphin's head and tail. The dolphin's head has a diamond for an eye, 3/4 carat. I bought it at a pawn shop, but it wasn't cheap. She still ain't saying nothing. She's just sitting there. What the hell? Finally, I tell her I could exchange it, or take her to the shop and let her choose herself. Either way is fine by me. But Evie shakes her head, says no again. When she finally talks again, all she says is, Rex, I can't take this. Why the hell not? We're friends and friends buy each other gifts, don't they? She shakes her head and looks me in the eye. But Rex, it's just too much. So, thank you.
Thank you. Before we move to our next literary magazine, I just want to say a quick word about how literary magazines stay afloat. And there is, in fact, only one way they do, and that is when you subscribe to them. So please come to this wonderful resource and discover the magazines that speak to you and places like this reading. And then when you do find one that really represents your community of fellow readers, I hope you will subscribe to it so that it can keep supplying you with great literature. And now, nestled between our two grand dames here tonight, Subtropics, who have not even been around for 3 years, but already are on our list of magazines we think of that will be around for quite a long time. And I will now call Sydney Wade to come on up and introduce our next reader.
Thank you so much. I'm absolutely delighted to be here. We are delighted to be invited to the same party as the Literary and Hudson Reviews, reviews that I've admired for many, many years. And what Jeff just said about subscription, I actually happen to have brought some subscription cards, so in case you're interested, I'll pass them around. Subtropics, as Jeff said, we started publishing in January of 2006. And we've really had some good success. The magazine has been noted. Of course, I think we publish the best poetry and fiction around. We are also dedicated to publishing works of literature in translation. I've published poems from the Farsi, French, Spanish. I'm going to have an all poetry in translation issue this coming January. As Jeff said, we have had some very good success. We have poems and short stories in every issue of the Best American Poetry and Short Stories since we've been publishing, so I think that's a good sign. I'm here to introduce Michael Loughran, who is a marvelous, fresh, new voice. I find his poetry compelling, absolutely original, and very strange, which I think is a wonderful compliment. He's published so far in Tin House, in the Harvard Review, in American Letters and Commentary, Lit, Jubilat, Cabinet, Subtropics, and Octopus. He has poems forthcoming in The Hat, the Boston Review. He teaches at the Community College of Philadelphia and lives in South Philadelphia. And I'm delighted to introduce this new voice to you.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for being here. This is tricky. Is that okay? Is that a good amount? Okay. I need a tall person one, or a lanky person one. I thought what I'd do is maybe read six or seven short poems and then two longer ones. So the first one is called The Wrong War. I say it seems worse now, and you say what does, and I say everything. And you say what everything, and I say traffic, horse flies, the happiness quotient, new dances, local news people, and the war. Which war? You say, and I say the surprising one, and you say which surprising one, and I say the one when some guy climbed up the wrong horse and surprised everyone. You've confused your wars again, you say. I know, I say, but that horse was awfully tall. This is called Pastiche with Occasional Botany and Art. When humans avoid low temperatures, love exists, which accounts for Miro's flame in space and nude woman. It resembles a cat ingesting a raindrop version of itself. In good health, corn plants can transpire 2 quarts of water in a day, whereas the succulents traffic water to their fleshy parts through wide root networks, hoarding it there sportingly. Conversely, bamboo commits suicide every 33 to 66 years. Nowadays, said Miro at 67, I rarely start a picture from a hallucination. Melvin Calvin discovered one single organ can perform a large number of functions. The human heart is known to migrate swiftly and without warning, like a glove tossed from the height of a tall statue. I think I might have arranged these by accident in order of words so that they get, like each one gets progressively longer. So it'll be like we're on a weird train or something going somewhere. This is called First Sentence of My Novel.
I had been on vacation for 1 week and 3 days when I got a most dreadful call. Just 2 days before had appeared on the front porch of my home a badly injured and whimpering blue jay. And moreover, according to the caller, my catty-corner neighbor, Mrs. Walker, there was some amount of dispute in town as to whether the fallen object was actually a blue jay or something more strange and unwieldy. In fact, she reported, there had been some whisperings that the fallen object was, in actuality, something much worse than a hurt bird, that several of the husbands from my block had drawn straws, the shortest of which went to Mr. Lynn Fowley, who quietly and straightly journeyed to the porch in question and lingered there for some time, but returned without sufficient data upon which to build a hypothesis, which lack of hypothesis brought a simple thought into my head, a thought which occurred swiftly, like meat flung onto a wooden table. Surely, I thought to myself, this vacation is over. This is called Idea Moratorium. It takes place actually at a bonfire at Sydney's house, as a matter of fact. Not in the house, but outside of the house. Idea Moratorium. Some of us like to watch the player pianos writhe under the force of the air, but others just shuffle around buying hampers, hair curling youthfully in the humidity. Suddenly, my friend disproves the existence of metaphor by hitting himself in the knee with a bat. We're standing around like two tall loaves of bread. He calls a moratorium on ideas, so we stay up late listening to sad music, waiting for the world to wink from somewhere beyond itself, from an eye beyond the alpha cloud. We love how the wink occurs unforced, how seeing it feels like a penalty. We believe the music drifting through the clouds is unbearably sad. We trust those large talkative birds. We trust them because we are allowed to. This next one takes its title and its first line from a Gerald Stern poem, and it's called Alone. I was alone, and I could do what I wanted. I was reading again. I was thinking of reading. I could see the gold inside every heart. I heard jazz. The world buzzed. It was imaginary. The jazz explainer spoke. 2 years or so went by. I was full of ideas, full of warm ideas. I was alone inside the tiny chain they made. I was alone when the make-believe things rose up and meant to be feared, and I feared them dutifully, and it rained. Skittish clouds clouded up the sky. A wet pigeon appraised me. I hated the world's long guesswork, hated its little violations. I hated hats. I hated hots. I kept telling people Werner Herzog said it's a humiliation to be anything, but I knew he never did. Everything was half true. Everything was rising. Somebody's motorcycle was chewing up the golden air. I listened forever. This is called A Few Days. What I do is I stand perfectly still and pretend to be a statue of a tall man in a jacket. I whisper into the heartless wind, and then I stop whispering. I stand in the mist, in the center of all misting. I become a little stick sticking straight up into the mist with arms and a golf pencil. What I do is I leave the world behind. I leave its funny wide maw behind. I find a place of odd rest. What I do is I wonder about the meaning of the sun peeking out like a child's orange head. What a relief it is to cross my legs and stare into the fog and feel actual. To know in my heart that I am someone else. To witness a bird ingest a bread crust bigger than its head by 2 times. To have on this jacket with its wool vampiric collar. To walk into the center of the rain, into the bright light of the storm. I venture out, and then I venture in. When I describe this, I feel radiant, then guilty, then tingly, then queer, and finally, if I'm lucky, I feel average. This is called At Least. At least the growl of the buses becomes eventually a message unto itself, although who knows what the message is. We'd like to say it's all an ocean, but of course we won't say that. Instead, we'll say inside every stranger is a smaller stranger, and within that stranger, another one who knows all your secrets. In the rain, you become an amalgamation of every film character ever rained upon. At home, you're a creep. We're sorry to say it, but it's true, and we'll say it again, a creep. But at least the rain is on its way. At least there's no choir beneath your window weeping. At least the world reduces eventually to a hush. At least there is shopping for houseplants, or spitting, or standing up. The knowledge that inside everything, a little something flickers. When you crack open your leg, you find a tiny leg inside, but are not surprised, and it is this that surprises you. The odd night arrives when you climb into the car and drive through the cold air into the darkness. Suddenly, you become an idea you didn't want. So I'll do two poems now, and that'll be it. The first one is called Letters to Noel. I guess it takes place sort of one-eighth here in New York and one-eighth in Florida, and then six-eighths in Philadelphia. So there'll be a test after this. Letters to Noel. There are 8,700 species of birds in the universe. I had lunch, white rice, on a bench in a park. It's all so easy. One minute the air tastes like hot sugar, and you're drinking coffee on your panoptical rooftop, all of everything in sight. Then I'm here on this porch, watching night rise up through a square of grass, rustling its numinous fingers. Here I am, place impervious to complaint, sun shining through the pouring rain. I say sort your documents, flatten your pleats, stabilize the laundry cycle. I'll try to count my blessings, but I do get sick sometimes watching these long white birds, their twiggy feet. I draw the shades, and then I peek through. Painted the trim, icy sherbet, ate salad, did not wash dishes, drank 1.5 bottles of beer, read sports page twice, allowed dog to chew pants, did not wash self, muddied floor, cleaned floor halfway, put on Nick Drake, turned off Nick Drake, thought about Nick Drake, cleaned paint from knuckles, turned on Nick Drake, worked on poems, hunted for roaches, stared at recycling bin. The dog is licking shellac from the banister, and I'm measuring my spiritual health as he gallops the street looking for a crotch. It took a certain man to write the song called Coney Island Baby, and some days I could be that man. Others I couldn't, so I just stay in bed and somehow doodle. Night tears its perforated edge, reveals something slightly indiscreet. At best, it can be said, the streetlights are wheezing. Slept without regard, got leery, clumsy, nostalgic, poem brave, reprised with God talk, undone, nearly silent but for periodic tooth whittle. Elsewhere you slipped feet first into the prayer book of sleep, headlong into a dream. I am the heart lump that ticks within your area. I defy any law that can't be sung. Woke up. Talked on phone with Simon about Atkins, horror films, the schemes of democracies, handshakes, feather beds, writing ugly, unwritable truths, mother guilt, happiness without sarcasm, Mikhail's new job with an actual ex-gangster, Valentine's Day, the lack of a Harold and Maude soundtrack, Los Angeles traffic, and his thing, now finished. Like most things, he said, it's hard to be proud of it more than once. Nothing to drink all morning but carrot juice extracted from a bottle. Nothing to say but this. Without you, the house rattles like a wooden cube in a glass. To wit, it's windy. The breeze sounds old against these windows. It blows like a bad cough. It's no metaphor to the dog who jumps, terrified, and chews on pens all day. Met the neighbor's new dog, Chopper, paid two bills, mailed letter to my sister, got dressed up, wore a real shirt with buttons, wore a sweater, went for coffee, went for stamps, ate a sandwich, talked about the Phillies with my dad on the phone, listened to Mahler, did not teach dog to fetch, read one paragraph of Adorno, built makeshift ottoman, ate a second sandwich, used a paper towel, not a plate. I continue to misunderstand almost every poem until my students explain it. In a garden, of course. I continue to misquote every lyric of Bob Dylan's. I continue to own but one Bob Dylan record. I continue my catalog of bird movements, back limb pirouette, feather whirring pinafore, toe hold pitter patter, and quizzical eyes through the window. Walter Pater, what a shame, didn't know an instrument. Borodin said, during the winter, I can only compose when I'm too ill to give my lectures. So my friends, reversing the usual custom, never say to me, I hope you're well, but I do hope you are ill. This morning, his quartet sounds like a small object coming to a halt on an almost flat surface. When I step out into the green world, I'll stand there until it is what I say it is. So I'll just do one more, another slightly long one. Excuse me. It's called What We Need the Most Will Be at First Refused. Watching the local news alone again, oh well. A building fell and has damaged and been damaged by bad intentions all around. And you are sleeping. This wasn't on the news, but is more true. You sleep, and the dog sleeps, and very few people would care, but I do, and for this, the three of us are lucky. There's the matter of listening to old records. There's the belief that all dogs go to heaven, that wine is sometimes heart medicine, sometimes not. Tomorrow we'll go to the beach and have 95% as much fun as we thought we might, which is more than most. Luck arrives blind as a cavity, which is a different luck, the luck of not luck. Four books, at least, and a fruit salad will be dragged along with us, but only the magazines will be read and only the chips eaten. One day is fine, the next less so, the last bears down regardless, worse even than the idea for it, which was bad enough. One way or the other, as all literature says, by hook or by crook, as my mother says. Drink as much as you'd like, as rock music says. In this impossible August, the leaves wilt, but why shouldn't they? And the dog oversleeps, and the neighbors are out and about, and the branches are quiet and fine. One is lucky to say such things, and lucky to stop saying them too, or to say them only in one's head, like a prayer misdirected. Why not? Each bus is just as good as all the others. They all somehow become a metaphor for the world. So to catch one feels like a real shot of good luck, and the people on it are sometimes lousy, sometimes not. There's the smell, don't forget. And the slogan we thought up one night coming home, all you have to do is ding. And a few years before, the song I would sing waiting for the subway about the dog before we got him. It was summer then as well, but too far away to explain anymore. How to recall memory like a musician with perfect pitch? Is it an urban legend, like the gerbil stuck in the butt, etc.? But no less real, no less interesting. And why are you so interesting, dear weather? Whose fault, mine or yours? You are the book I read slowly so as not to finish, a daily trophy everyone wins. Rain or not, either way I love describing you, especially to the neighbors who wear shorts. Tonight is August 3rd, It comes creeping in like a 17-legged cat out of a dark, dark hole. You can tell the neighbors are on the brink, and who could blame them? The sky is the color of old paper. The air smells like a grandmother's attic. The trees frown. The dog checks and then rechecks the perimeter of our little room here. Tomorrow I will go out into the world and hope not to waste too much of anything. You say I should visit you at work, which I will do. Who wouldn't? Not doing requires more energy than doing, which is perhaps the reason for the success of Just Do It and the failure of Just Say No. Just now I realize the windows have not been open in 1 month. Now the cars nose dumbly down the street into their predestined spots. And now the birds, now the breeze and sun and litter, now the old neighbor, and now his older sister, and now I think of a restaurant, and now the phone wires slouch into the tree and disrupt its uppermost branch, and now a plastic bag is permitted to ease into the sky, and now Suzanne calls to say she'll never be able to afford a house, and to ask about a dentist, and I tell her they said something nice about Kurt again in the paper. The dog sleeps curled up with his nose atop his feet, which is ordinary only if you aren't currently looking at the dog. Sitting in the park is ordinary until you sit in the park. More coffee is ordinary until its presentation. None of this can be predicted any more than thwarted, initiated, described, etc. The world is a whole lot of this and that, about which only a fool cares to comment. And yet the tapping of one's feet through the house from room to room. I go and sit on the stoop and reminisce about my broken car window with whomever walks past. Anyway, here goes nothing. The sky is white, gray, and silent. When the two birds land, the wire shimmies like the surface of a narrow black river. Thanks.
Thank you. Before our final selection, I want to point out there are tiny pencils for all of you, I think. These are your keepsake souvenirs. If you've been coming to all of these readings by now, you can have made a small raft or furniture. But the reason you have them is to fill out the fluorescent surveys you have in front of you. I want to quickly thank a few funders who make this possible. In addition to the generosity of the New York Public Library, these free programs continue because of the generosity of the National Endowment for the Arts and New York State Council and the Arts, a state agency. And our way of thanking them is by giving them some feedback. So please take a moment and fill out these surveys. It's what we use to continue to get funding to do free programs like this. It's also your opportunity to sign up our mailing list to find out about free programs here in New York City. And just leave that part off if you don't want to know about other free programs. And now last but not least, as you know, we've already heard fiction and poetry, and we're going to conclude with a memoir, another great genre represented by Literary Magazines. And I'm going to now summon Paula Dietz of the Hudson Review, which I was delighted to see was just featured in Time Magazine, and really a wonderful little piece. And now Paula Dietz to introduce our final reader for the evening.
It's a special pleasure to be in a periodical room. I was just thinking, everyone else was thanking Karen and Jeffrey as I do, that I first discovered the Hudson Review in the periodical area of Smith College. And in those days you had the Periodical Guide Index, which actually told you when you were researching a paper what was in various magazines in the magazine world, and seeing many magazines was very important to us. We were absolutely thrilled to get this phone call from CLMP this time, because this April is the 60th anniversary of the Hudson Review, and we had all kinds of events already planned, and now this has now become the first one in the list. We're publishing our issue next week. We have a wonderful essay by Seamus Heaney on Wordsworth, and a totally unpublished story by Penelope Fitzgerald, and lots of other exciting parts. And to celebrate the anniversary itself, we're having a concert at the Guggenheim Museum on April 27th at 3 o'clock. And it's going to be Dana Gioia's poetry set to music by five contemporary composers, it's going to be a world premiere concert. And if we have information about all of this in the back. But beside the issue in the concert, we have a very new and exciting event at the Hudson Review, and that is that we are publishing our first anthology since the early 60s. The book is called Rites of Passage, and it came about very quickly like this. In 2001, we began a Writers in the School program at two high schools in East Harlem. We wanted to be part of the curriculum, not just bring in a writer for the day. So we began selecting stories, memoirs, poetry with the teachers of the high school. The students studied them for about 2 weeks, and we brought in the writer who read for a while, and then we began having discussions, and we thought this was just going to be a wonderful program, and we would keep doing it. But the more I began hearing the discussions, the more I began to understand that what the program was really doing was teaching high school students how to integrate literature into their lives, because the discussions always migrated to how their lives related to the stories and memoirs that they were reading. And so for the first time, they were learning how reading is a whole experience. It's like having another life, and that life also becomes part of yours. So we got the idea from that to anthologize first the top 10 stories that the students had enjoyed over that time. And we found a publisher, Ivan R.D. in Chicago, a wonderful publisher who understood our vision. And we collected 21 stories and 10 memoirs from the last 25 years. Each of these stories has in them a transforming moment. When the writer, in a sense, it's when the writer realizes that he or she is up against a morally complex world. It's that moment when you not know that life can never be the same again, that you've entered a new realm. And what's so interesting to us is that the variety of the ways in which these writers, both emerging and new writers, evoke this realization creates a kind of quality of surprise and even of suspense. So Barbara Wasserman, our writer today, whose memoir, Spain, 1948, we published in autumn of 2000, it was her first appearance in the Hudson Review, appears in this anthology. And so this is actually the first reading from the anthology. We're delighted to have her today. As you see from your notes, Barbara worked for many years as a researcher and a writer of documentary films. And in 1967, she edited The Bold New Woman, a collection of writings by women. And I think we're in for a very exciting tour now with the memoir, Spain, 1948, by Barbara Wasserman.
Barbara.
I'm actually now going to present, the book's just arrived today, so I'm presenting Barbara with the first copy as one of the contributors.
Thank you all for coming, both those I know and those I don't. We take quite a bit more than 20 minutes to read the entire piece, so and I do want to give a sense of the whole story, so I will talk a little bit about what led up to my trip to Spain in 1948, and read from the text primarily, and also summarize some portions of the story, but I won't distinguish between when I'm summarizing and when I'm reading. In the spring of 1948, I went to Europe for the first time. I was just a year out of college, and I was going with my mother. My father had been there for some months, working for an international refugee organization, and my mother was going over to join him. My brother, Norman, and his wife, Beatrice, were also living in Paris, studying at the Sorbonne on the GI Bill, while waiting for Norman's first novel to be published here. Most of the time, I hung out with them and their friends, mainly Americans. They had also come to know, however, a group of anti-Franco Spanish refugees most of them student exiles. The Spaniards were eager to spring some of their friends in Spain, who had been imprisoned for political activity, and get them across the border, and to do this they needed a car. Norman had bought a little French car, the Peugeot, which at the time, because of the need for dollars, was available only to foreigners, but could be sold to a French citizen when one was leaving the country. Norman and me decided to help. Before I arrived in France, they had made one trip to Madrid with 21-year-old Paco Benegoitia, the only one of the students who was not a refugee and could therefore travel back and forth. But when they got to Madrid, Paco found that the circumstances for the escape were not propitious, and they returned to Paris with their mission unaccomplished. Norman's novel, The Naked and the Dead, was published in May. And when the rave reviews began to arrive in June, he decided it was time to return to the States. While he and B were preparing to leave, Paco learned that the conditions for an escape operation had now improved. This is flush with success. Norman decided that he would donate the Peugeot and the spec to the Spanish resistance. However, there was no way the Spaniards could use the car themselves, since most of them couldn't go to Spain, and Paco didn't drive. Norman asked me if I would like to go. Oh, wouldn't I? There was a small problem, however. I, too, had not yet learned how to drive. However, Norman said that he would teach me, and so he did. We also invited along another young woman, Barbara Probst, whom I had met on the boat to France, to come along with us. She was as eager to go to Spain as I was, and she had a driver's license. Why did I want so much to go? I didn't know very much about Spain, except that the bad guys had won their civil war. My politics were more romantic than ideological. For me, the mission evoked the heroism of the resistance movement in France during the Nazi occupation. At the end of July, Barbara, Paco, and I left for Spain. We spent about a week in Madrid while Paco went about making arrangements, and in between times tried to educate us about Spanish culture. Finally, he told us that we would leave on Sunday. The guys we were going to free, or rather, les types, as Barbara and I had taken to calling them since with Paco we only spoke French, were in a forced labor camp about 10 miles northwest of Madrid. On Sunday, they would be going to noon mass at the Escorial, just a few miles from the labor camp. I had no idea of how we would hook up with them. Sunday morning arrived. Paco threw into the back seat of the car a package containing two sets of men's clothing. He was also carrying two sets of false papers. We reached the Escorial well before noon. As we wandered through corridors and rooms and gazed at paintings, Paco would occasionally disappear to case the joint in the situation. And I believe he stashed the packet of clothes in a bathroom. But most of the time he spent giving us a guided tour of the art, architecture, and history of the Escorial, an enormous palace and chapel complex built in the 16th century by Philip II. Perhaps Paco's purpose was to make us look like tourists for the benefit of anyone who might notice us. But as always, with regard to things Spanish, his lecture was genuinely enthusiastic. I absorbed none of it. At last, he told us to go back to the car and wait. Barbara sat in front. I sat in back, as Paco had instructed. The sun was hot. The air was dry. The oppressive bulk of the Escorial stretched endlessly along the empty street. Not a soul. Silence. I was beginning to think it just possible we might never again see Paco when he emerged through the entrance door with Letip. Whatever we might have been expecting, it was a shock to see three college boys sauntering down the steps, looking like three college boys. Latif, Nicholas, and Manolo jammed into the back with me. Paco jumped into the front seat. "Vis, vis, vis," he said, and we were off, laughing a little hysterically. It all seemed so simple, so unremarkable, not unlike a jaunt through the beach. Latif and I looked at each other, smiling with the helpless amiability of strangers who have no language in common. They knew no English or French. Conversation had to be mediated through Paco, which made every question or comment weightier than one may have intended. And though I wasn't aware of it at the time, it was my first experience of how difficult it can be to talk to people with whom you have in common no friends, no work, no past. We were stopped a few times by the Guardia Civil, and the false papers worked. After we passed Madrid, there were few checkpoints and almost no cars. We realized we were hungry and were planning to eat lunch at a restaurant with a celebrated view. And then the accident happened. Barbara was still driving. We were in the mountains, the road climbing, debane curving. Suddenly, we went into a skid, careened a bit, and ended up, fortunately, sliding into the mountain rather than off of it. The car jumped a small rock and stopped. We were pretty shaken up, particularly when we looked at the sheer drop at the other side of the road, but we weren't hurt. We lifted the car back onto the road, and to our relief, the motor started. But we soon realized something was seriously wrong. The tires squealed continuously, even on a straightaway, as if the car were in a never-ending curve that it was taking too fast. Since it was still hundreds of miles to Barcelona, we decided we'd better find out what the problem was. We stopped at the first town that had a service station. They only sold gas, but told us there was a good mechanic in a village a couple of miles up the mountain. We turned off the road. The car wheezed and shrieked up a rutted and rock-strewn dirt path. Less than a half mile into it, I felt as far from civilization as the moon, and the village we finally arrived at looked as if it had grown from a landscape as barren. The mechanic, it turned out, was the local expert on oxcart repairs. Our arrival was possibly the most exciting event of the year. A rod between the axle and the wheel had been bent out of shape. The surgery was pretty primitive, executed with an iron mallet, but it worked, and we set off again. Having lost a couple of hours, we gave up on the elegant lunch. I don't remember what, where, or if we ate. Barbara and I took turns driving. As the night wore on, I tried to sleep while she drove, but only managed to nod off for a few minutes at a time. Therefore, at 3 a.m, when Barbara turned the wheel over to me again, I was bleary. Everyone else fell asleep, and the car was deathly quiet. However, I managed to open my eyes often enough to stay on the road until daybreak, when I had the sense to tell Barbara to take over again. Paco, who was getting a little nervous about how far police alert would have reached by this time, decided we should turn south on a back road and enter Barcelona by way of Tarragona. This route was barely distinguishable from a cross-country trail, and as the car bumped along those last couple of hours, I was vaguely aware that Paco was helping another very sleepy Barbara to steer. We pulled into Barcelona around mid-morning. Paco found a safe house for himself and the guys. Barbara and I went to a hotel. The next day, Paco took us all up to the unfinished Gaudi Cathedral and expounded on its architectural significance. Over a picnic lunch, we studied the map on which he had outlined the escape route. While he remained in Barcelona, the rest of us would leave later that afternoon and travel north. About 30 miles before the French border, we would come to the first of four checkpoints. They would look at our papers, list all our names on an official form, which we would have to show at each checkpoint, and which would be collected from us at the last one. Just before we reached the Spanish border town of Puigcerda, between the third and fourth checkpoints, Paco gave us the exact mileage, the road ran for a bit along the border. At that point, all that separated Spain from France was a high hill. Nicholas and Manolo were to get off there. By this time, it would be well past dark. Go over the hill, and voila, they would be free. Barbara and I were to stay the night in Puigcerda, then cross in the morning to Bourg Madame on the French side. From there, a back road in the mountains would take us to the village of Osatia, which, as the crow flies, was not more than 5 kilometers from where the guys would have left the car. With any luck, they would be there waiting for us by the time we arrived. Then we would all drive to Paris. Amazingly, it almost worked. We passed the first three checkpoints without any trouble, dropped Nicholas and Manolo off at the right spot, and through dint of massive incomprehension, we managed to avoid giving the paper with all our names to the guards at the last checkpoint, thus preventing an alert. We checked into an hotel in Puigcerda, the only one that had room turned out to be a whorehouse. We also had some trouble with a border official in the morning because we had not sufficiently observed the rules of exchange. That problem solved with dollars, we crossed to Bourg Madame and drove on to Osatia. They weren't there. A small bud of dread sprouted in my belly. Thus began the two longest days of my life. There was nothing to do but wait. Impossible to read. We didn't even talk much. What, after all, was there to talk about when everything else in our lives seemed insignificant? With each hour, I sank a little further into the realization that we might not be living charmed lives. For the first time in my life, I began to recognize that my actions could have enormous consequences, not only for myself, but for others. Nicholas and Manolo had probably been caught. They might even be dead. We waited in Osatia for 2 days. Finally, we called Paris to find out if there was anything we could do. Inquiries were made in the hope that the guys had been taken by the French police. However, they had not shown up in an internment camp. In a blue funk, we drove back to Paris. Some days after we arrived, news came that Nicholas and Manolo were safe in France. Without a compass, they had lost their bearings almost as soon as they left the car. Afraid to travel during the day, they had wandered by night for all of that week, and probably back and forth across the border. Weak and famished, they finally stumbled onto a road where the signs were in French, and they gladly followed it into the arms of the French police. The next few weeks they spent in an internment camp. Paco, too, had trouble getting out of Spain. The authorities soon traced the escape to him and put out a warrant for his arrest. He managed to escape on a small fishing boat that took him back to France. By the time they all got to Paris, I had returned to New York. I never again saw Manolo, and it was 20 years before I met Nicholas again. Having become a professor in South America, he moved to New York for a while to teach at NYU, and sometime after Franco died, he went back to Spain. While he lived in New York, we would occasionally see each other at parties. But we were never easy with each other, and I never asked if he had any regrets about the way he had spent his life. But something Barbara told me has made me wonder. She learned from Paco that there had been a third man in the prison whom Paco had wanted to free, but who decided not to come with us. He was released a couple of years later and continued to live in Spain, which of course was what they all wanted, to live in Spain. Instead, Nicholas and Manolo, who had probably expected that they would soon be able to return, spent the next 30 years as exiles. And Paco, who died in an automobile accident in 1966, was never able to go back. So I cannot help but wonder if their lives might have been better if we had not been there to help the guys escape. The passing of the years has developed my taste for irony, and so I am not exactly surprised to realize now that this one act in my life about which I have always felt so virtuous is still subject to a most basic lesson, that one's deeds, no matter one's intentions, almost never result in unambiguous returns. I'm grateful, however, I did not know this 50, now 60 years ago. I only knew then that given the chance to rescue a couple of political prisoners, I had to go to Spain. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you'll all join us for a reception right outside. Let me also quickly thank Tasha Sorensen, who curated tonight's program. Is Tasha back there? Thanks, Tasha. And hope we'll see you all next month, second Tuesday of the month. Thanks for coming.